controversial topic in the world, and that is Islam. You are listening to The Logic of Islam with Dr. Carl Goldberg. I just want to make a quick reminder that beginning next week, this show, because of daylight savings time, will take place at 1 p.m. Eastern time and 10 in the morning California time. Arizona time will remain the same at 10 o'clock. So as always, remember that the purpose of this show is so that you can explain the essence of Islam concisely and clearly and logically to our fellow citizens. We have to do that, and I really want to motivate you to become active and not just passive listeners. We need more people who understand Islam to be able to explain it to those citizens who don't. It is extremely important, because if our citizenry does not understand Islam, there's no way that we can support our legislators or educate them so that they will take the proper measures to defend us against the Islamic threats. So please, help spread the truth about the threat to our national security from Islam by reminding people that you come in contact with why we should be concerned about the Islamic threat. Because even if they might not be interested in Islam, Islam is interested in them. Let me quickly recap that there are three existential threats from Islam that we are facing, and ISIS is not one of them, even though ISIS attracts most of the attention. The three Islamic threats are, first of all, the Islamic Republic of Iran. They are a large, very powerful country. They are armed with the most advanced weapons of mass destruction. They are working on intercontinental missiles, and they are also working on nuclear warheads as well as biological warheads. So it is possible that they could present an existential threat to us, especially if they have an electromagnetic impulse bomb that they can explode over the United States that will knock out our electric grid for many months, which of course will lead to the death of millions of people, because practically our whole society depends on electronics these days. Even delivery of your water depends on electronics, and food and production of food and distribution of food. All of those services will be totally disrupted in the event of an electromagnetic pulse bomb. The Islamic Republic of Iran is, or shortly will be, capable of delivering such a weapon. So that's the first existential threat from Islam. The second existential threat from Islam is massive Muslim migration. We already see this in Europe, and we know, for example, that the Muslim religious leaders and Gaddafi also told us a number of years ago that they will conquer Europe without firing a shot. How do they do that? Well, you introduce millions and millions of Muslims into Europe who form parallel societies, and they do not assimilate. Certainly, they don't assimilate in terms of the values of Europe, and so they continue to promote their Islamic values, which require them eventually to promote Sharia law throughout the entire world, including their host countries. And we know from opinion polls that, in fact, at least two-thirds of the European Muslims want Sharia law to be the law of the land. Now, that seems to be somewhat a lower percentage so far in the United States, where only approximately half or slightly more than half of American Muslims want Sharia law to be the law of the land. But remember this, that the communities are organized by the mosques and by the religious leaders, and that organization of a community makes them far stronger than their actual numbers would let us believe. So, for example, if we say that only about half of American Muslims want Sharia law, that doesn't indicate how strong the Muslim community is, which wants Sharia law, because the community is led by those religious Muslims from the Muslim Brotherhood who want Sharia law. And so the more Muslims you get into the United States, they will be organized by their communities. And the fact that many of them are passive and don't particularly want Sharia law, many of them, that doesn't make much difference, because they will be organized by those Muslims who do want Sharia law. So then the second existential threat from Islam is the massive Muslim migration. They form parallel societies, and they will continue to expand because their reproduction rate is far higher than the reproduction rate of the rest of the American population. So this mass Muslim migration must be stopped, and I urge you to talk to your legislators, urge them to support in every way possible to support President Trump's attempt to restrict Muslim immigration. It can be done, not on the basis of religion, but on the basis of ideology. Because Islam, as we know, and we'll talk about this more, is an ideology. They want to reorganize society and not merely pray to their God. That is the difference between Islam and other religions. We'll get to that again more also in a moment. You must always stress how Islam is fundamentally different from all other religions. So that's the second existential threat, is the change in our population from our normal American population to a Muslim-oriented population. It will happen through mass immigration and out-reproducing the host population. The third existential threat from Islam is the subversive jihad, the stealth jihad, as Robert Spencer said. And by the way, he wrote a whole book on the stealth jihad. And we need to be aware of this because the Muslim community in the United States, again, is led by the Muslim supremacists who are following the Muslim Brotherhood program to infiltrate all of our institutions, government institutions from dog catcher to the White House, educational institutions from grade school through the universities. They write the chapters on Islam in the textbooks that our children in high school use. They control pretty much who gets hired to teach Islam and Middle Eastern politics in the universities. They have outreach programs to our clergy, the Christian and Jewish clergy, and the purpose of those outreach programs is to have those Christian and Jewish clergy tell their own congregations that Islam is a religion of peace. So everywhere we have this infiltration of our society. It gets really much farther than that. We've talked about the various aspects of the stealth jihad before, and we will do it again. It is extremely important because that is the third existential threat. It's like multiple metastatic cancer tumors in the body. They will continue to grow and infiltrate the vital organs of our body. That includes the all of the organs of the government and the educational organs. And eventually they will be able to take power if they are not stopped. And that is why it is so important to focus attention on the stealth jihad. Again, this is far more important than ISIS. ISIS is mildly important, but it does not present an existential threat to us. It does, however, attract everybody's attention. So please, don't be misled by the sensationalism of ISIS. We will take action against ISIS, and we'll be talking about that more in just a few minutes. But ISIS is not the most important Islamic issue. The three issues are the Islamic Republic of Iran, the demographic jihad, that is the Muslim invasion, peaceful invasion of the West, and the stealth jihad. As usual, I would like to recommend readings for you to increase your knowledge about Islam and the Muslim world so that you can then more authoritatively talk to other people and convince them. It's so important that you do that. You must become activists, again, and not merely passive listeners. First of all, you should take a look at www.jihadwatch.org. That's Robert Spencer's indispensable website for goings-on in the Muslim world, articles from various places. And he links those events to the Islamic doctrines. That is what is so important, and we'll be talking about that also. We always do here. The whole purpose is to see what is going on in the Muslim world and link it to Islamic doctrine. So few people understand what Islamic doctrine is all about that they have no idea how much of the world is determined by what is in the Quran, which is, of course, the source of Islamic doctrine. So check out Robert Spencer's website. And if you haven't read his bestseller book, please do. It's The Politically Incorrect Guide to Islam by Robert Spencer. And that will be an introduction to Islam for you, one of the best introductions that I can think of. And then finally, of course, you must read the Quran. If you haven't done so, please set yourself the task of doing so. Make it a project. Get yourself a copy. You can get free copies if you want. Go on the internet, Google free copy of the Quran, and you'll get websites that will send it to you. Or just go and pay a few dollars at any bookstore, or go into an Islamic cultural center that is a major mosque and simply ask for one, and they'll give you one. And the advantage, by the way, of getting the Quran from the mosque is that you know it is approved, that translation is approved by the Islamic religious authorities. That gives you more authority. Also, when you talk to other people, you will quote the Quran, and they will say, oh, well, that's only a translation. It's not the real Quran. And then you will respond, well, this is the translation that is approved by the Islamic religious authorities, and therefore we have a right to assume that it tells the truth about the Quran. So please, get yourself a copy of the Quran and read it. Another book that I've been recommending, and this concerns that third existential threat from Islam, the stealth jihad. Please get this book by John Guandolo. He's a former FBI counterintelligence agent. And his book is called Raising a Jihadi Generation, Understanding the Muslim Brotherhood Movement in America. And this is why, when you read that, you'll understand why it is so important to have our government declare the Muslim Brotherhood to be a terrorist organization. The Muslim Brotherhood has already been declared a terrorist organization by five countries in the world, four of which are Muslim countries. They understand the danger from the Muslim Brotherhood, and we need to understand it also, and therefore we need to officially declare the Muslim Brotherhood to be a terrorist organization. That will allow us to take action against the dozens of Muslim Brotherhood front groups in the United States, including the Council on American-Islamic Relations. If you want to know more about the second existential threat to our society, that is the mass Muslim invasion of North America, and of course in Europe it's been going on for more years, get a copy of this book called Modern Day Trojan Horse, The Islamic Doctrine of Immigration by Sam Solomon. That's the Modern Day Trojan Horse. Excellent book. Sam Solomon is an ex-Muslim, and he and his co-author, Elias Makdisi, they give you all of the Islamic sacred texts which talk about using the doctrine of immigration in order to conquer the world, which, of course, is Islam's goal. Remember also, when you talk to other people, stress how Islam is fundamentally different from all other religions because it is a so-called complete way of life. They tell us that. It's a complete way of life. They also call it a complete code of life. And when they say code, they are referring to Sharia law. A code is mandatory. And they also call Islam a comprehensive ideology. Other Islamic authorities will talk about the Islamic Sharia law as authoritarian and even totalitarian. Well, it certainly is when others talk about it as a complete way of life, or a comprehensive ideology. That's simply other words for totalitarian. So we are talking about Islam as a totalitarian ideology, and that is the way we need to see it, not as just a religion. It is a religion. We'll be talking about that more in just a bit also. But it is an ideology, and we need to attack Islam in the United States as an ideology. We cannot do it as a religion. So always stress that Islam is not a religion like other religions, because it is a totalitarian and imperialist ideology. And it follows that if Islam is not a religion like other religions, it should not be treated like other religions. There's a very good case to be made for that, and that is the case you need to make when you talk to other people. So today we're going to be talking about ISIS in Afghanistan, mass executions in the Gulf states and Jordan, the allies fighting one another in Syria. Syria is a mess. and the Fatah, that is one of the Palestinian groups, military groups, they've fired rockets from Gaza. We'll be talking about that and the significance of that. And then we'll again discuss, is Islam a religion? And then we will continue our comparison of Christianity and Islam. So first of all, ISIS in Afghanistan. Now, we always think of Afghanistan as being controlled by the Taliban, and the Taliban, in fact, controls large portions of Afghanistan, but there's also a new force of Islam in Afghanistan, which is in competition with the Taliban. They have exactly the same ideology, of course. The ideology is Islamic supremacy and the institution of Sharia law, the establishment of Sharia law as the law of the land. Well, ISIS, of course, has ambitions that go beyond Afghanistan, whereas the Taliban is focused on Afghanistan alone. But both of those groups are active. They are actively murdering lots of other people in Afghanistan. And let's talk just a bit about ISIS. They seem to have been developing a new strategy in Afghanistan. Just last week, there was an attack in Kabul that killed at least 30 people, and the Islamic State claimed responsibility for that. This was somewhat different from its past assaults, because this time they appeared in a very well-protected hospital. And in order, it was a military hospital, in fact, in Kabul, in the capital. And when the security is so tight, this article says, that one cannot even get into a shopping mall without going through metal detectors. And so in order for ISIS to have planned this attack with five suicide bombers in a military hospital, they have to have an enormous organization, which, in fact, is very deeply embedded in the society of Afghanistan, in the security forces and so on. They were able to get past all of the security. Now, the question is, why are young men from Kabul and elsewhere in Afghanistan adopting the ISIS ideology? Remember, the ISIS ideology is Islamic supremacism, which claims to be setting up a state. By the way, what differentiates ISIS from the other so-called terrorist groups like Al-Qaeda and Taliban and so on are that ISIS claims to be a caliphate. They are controlling large swaths of territory, like a state. That's why they call themselves an Islamic state. They collect taxes. They provide various kinds of state and government services. This is different from the other terrorist groups, which merely terrorize people. And so what's going on in Afghanistan is you've got lots of young people who are now joining ISIS. Why? Well, first of all, the ideology is attractive, because after all, these are religious Muslims who really believe that Islam should take over the world. And here's an organization, ISIS, that says that that is exactly what they're going to do. So there's the ideological basis for that. Now, in addition to that, you have economic conditions where you would have lots of unemployed young people, and ISIS is offering them money, salaries, if they go and fight for ISIS. This is a draw on lots of people, because they already accept the ideology, and now they have the additional incentive of money. Also, the fact that in recent months, the international security forces have been gradually drawn down in Afghanistan. And by the way, when they were there, that stimulated the economy. And now that our armed forces and other armed forces are leaving Afghanistan, that leads to a decline in economic activity, and that decline in economic activity means to less employment opportunity for young Muslim males and less money. And so ISIS steps in offering them money, and so they are more ready to join ISIS. It's not just a matter of unemployment, obviously. As I mentioned, the ideological basis is already in existence. These young men already understand that Islam is God's religion and that they are commanded to take over the world for Islam. So that's already in place, and then ISIS comes in and offers them a way to do that. ISIS also has a significant propaganda machine in Afghanistan. And so that's another way for ISIS to reach these people. The Taliban has been doing this all along. And so the Taliban, which is less of an international threat, is still extremely active in Afghanistan. And you can be pretty sure that once our armed forces leave, that the Taliban and together with ISIS will eventually take over the country. Why? Because of the ideology. Nobody talks about the ideology. When you read these articles about Afghanistan and other goings-on in the Muslim world, nobody talks about Islamic doctrine. But ultimately, if you look at it, Islamic doctrine is always lurking in the background. What it means is that the population has already come to believe, because that is what they are taught, that Islam is God's religion and must take over the world. So they already know that. They already believe that, and it's a matter of finding an opportunity to do that. In Afghanistan now, the threat of ISIS has an effect on Russia and Iran. Now, ISIS doesn't like the Shiites, and Iran is, of course, a Shiite country, and they are afraid of the anti-Shiite ISIS getting too close to its borders, and Russia also wants to keep ISIS influence away from the Muslim population in its backyard. And therefore, Russia and Iran will take action, or they are trying to, some action against ISIS, and that includes supporting the Taliban. Now, the Taliban is no picnic either, no bargain. They are thoroughly, thoroughly Islamic, which means they want complete Sharia law, as they used to have in Afghanistan, but they are more locally concentrated, and the Taliban does not present a threat to Iran and to Russia the way that ISIS does. And so you will find that Shiite Iran is lending some support to the Taliban, which of course is Sunni, and Russia is also. Next, we're going to turn our attention to the Gulf states, that is the United Arab Emirates, Bahrain, and Kuwait, and a couple of others, and Jordan, which lately have been carrying out mass executions. Just the other day, or the month rather, Bahrain shot and killed three men in its first executions since 2010. 10 days later, Kuwait hanged seven men in its first state-sanctioned killing since 2013. And then on March 4th, Jordan hanged 15 Muslim men, the largest single-day execution since the country brought back the death penalty 2 years ago. The charges against those who were killed include terrorism, rape, and murder. And what you have is that across the whole region, there's a fear of Islamist so-called extremism. Notice the article refers to Islamist extremism, not Islamic extremism. And why extremism? That's another euphemism that is so frequently used. What we're talking about is simply Islamic imperialism led by groups like ISIS and the others who want to institute Sharia law as the law of the land. And so these countries are in fear of the so-called Islamist extremism spilling over from the wars in Yemen and Syria. And the leaders of the Gulf states and Jordan are worried about that. Again, this whole idea springs from the Muslim Brotherhood. They're in the background of all of this. And the reason is that the Muslim Brotherhood wants Sharia law as the law of the land. And the leaders of these countries want only some Sharia law, and so these countries become the targets of the Muslim Brotherhood and these other so-called Islamist extremists, Muslim Brotherhood, ISIS, and so on, who want Sharia law, strict Sharia law. And so the Sharia law that the Muslim countries like Jordan and the Gulf states are practicing is not sufficiently strict for the Muslim Brotherhood. These countries practice Sharia law to an extent, but the Muslim Brotherhood and ISIS want full Sharia law. That is the difference, and so ISIS and the Muslim Brotherhood want to overthrow the governments of the Gulf states and Jordan, and that is why the leaders of these states are so very concerned. Now we see in this article here quote, we are seeing certain Middle Eastern countries paying less and less attention to the question of human rights in their attempts to tamp down on security threats and dissent. This is said by Peter Salisbury, a senior research fellow at the London-based think tank Chatham House. Let's look at that statement for a moment, that these Middle Eastern countries are paying less and less attention to the question of human rights. Well, excuse me, but they have never paid attention to the question of human rights in the Western sense of the term, because it cannot exist in any Muslim state, human rights as we understand the term, and that is why the Muslim countries, all 57 of them, came up with their own version of human rights called the Cairo Declaration of Human Rights in Islam. This was in 1991 already, because they could not accept our Universal Declaration of Human Rights. Our notion of human rights includes equality before the law for everybody, no matter what your religion is. Islam says that non-Muslims must be inferior legally. Our human rights speaks of gender equality. Islam says that women must be legally inferior. And there's a whole range of violations of our human rights, which Islam, in fact, supports. And so the Islamic notion of human rights is absolutely antithetical to our notion of human rights. And so when we have Westerners like this Peter Salisbury saying that the countries are now paying less and less attention to the question of human rights, that's nonsense. They never paid attention to human rights because their notion of human rights is very, very different. They all signed the Cairo Declaration of Human Rights in Islam, and the Cairo Declaration of Human Rights in Islam says that all human rights must come from Sharia law. And Sharia law, as I say, says that Muslims are superior to non-Muslims and men are superior to women, and that Muslims must make war on non-Muslims, and so on. We've talked about that many times on this show, what Sharia law is all about. So the question of human rights must be seen in this regard, and that no Muslim country can accept our notion of human rights. Even the moderate Muslim countries can follow human rights only to a limited degree. Again, because Islam itself, the doctrines of Islam, which nobody's talking about, it's the elephant in the room, so the doctrines of Islam talk and prohibit our notion of human rights from being the law of the land. This senior research fellow goes on to say, there is a sense that the priority for key Western governments is security and trade, not human rights. Well, Columbus discovers America, as they say. Western governments have never promoted human rights in the Islamic world because they never wanted to offend Muslim governments. Remember, one of our supposed allies in the Muslim world is Saudi Arabia. Well, Saudi Arabia has absolutely no notion of human rights in our sense of the term. Their human rights, again, based on Sharia law, because the constitution of their country, which is not written, is in fact the Quran. That is their source of human rights, and therefore they have no notion of human rights as we do. So it's not as if the Western countries are concerned only about trade and not human rights. Well, of course they are. That's normal. We cannot be concerned about human rights in Muslim countries because that would require essentially putting sanctions on all Muslim countries, and especially our so-called ally, Saudi Arabia. So it's no news that we don't care about human rights in Muslim countries. And, you know, you look about at the protests by women in the West, for example, when they talk about women's rights, and they come out protesting against the Donald Trump administration and protesting against America. Never a single word about the fact that Islam oppresses women in all Muslim countries to one degree or other. Again, that's part of human rights because Islam, the doctrines of Islam, again, and they're always influential in the policies of the Muslim countries, the doctrines of Islam say that women must be inferior. Now, Saudi Arabia has also been carrying out executions lately. And, for example, in 2016, that is just about a year ago in January, Saudi Arabia executed 47 people in the largest single-day killing since 1980. State officials convicted all 47 men of terrorism, claiming that most were al-Qaeda militants. The rest were disaffected Shia, and among the dead was a sheikh, a Shiite cleric, who advocated peaceful opposition to the country's ruling officials. Now, Saudi Arabia is overwhelmingly a Sunni country, and a very militant Sunni country. They follow Sharia law closely, but they have a Shia minority population in the eastern part of the country, near the oil wells, in fact. And so they're very concerned about the Shia, because the Shia owe their allegiance essentially to the Islamic Republic of Iran, which is Shiite. So you've got this tension inside Saudi Arabia. So Saudi Arabia is worried about two threats to its government. One is the Shias, and the other is Al-Qaeda, which is a derivative of the Muslim Brotherhood. Again, the Muslim Brotherhood and Al-Qaeda want to overthrow the regimes, even in Saudi Arabia, because after all, Saudi Arabia, even though it follows a strict Sharia, is not strict enough. The rulers of Saudi Arabia are the royal is the royal family, and they lead a lifestyle that is not at all Islamic. And so the Muslim Brotherhood and Al-Qaeda want to overthrow them too. By the way, Saudi Arabia is one of the countries that has declared the Muslim Brotherhood to be a terrorist organization. They used to support the Muslim Brotherhood for decades, and they spread Muslim Brotherhood propaganda all around the West. They built mosques that follow the Muslim Brotherhood, and those mosques still follow the Muslim Brotherhood, but the Saudis themselves have changed their policy to now presumably fight the Muslim Brotherhood, because they are afraid that the Muslim Brotherhood wants to overthrow them, and they are afraid correctly. The sheer number of executions carried out by Saudi Arabia has been, in fact, more than 300 in the last 2 years, and there was no international outcry, but the fact that Saudi Arabia has done this has essentially set the example for countries like Jordan and the Gulf states to increase their executions of so-called terrorists and people like Al-Qaeda and others who want to overthrow the Gulf state governments. After the Arab Spring, you know, we had all of these tremendous hopes for the Arab Spring that all of these Muslim countries were now going to turn democratic. Well, this was a total misunderstanding of the Muslim world, because the alternative to the authoritarian dictatorships in the Muslim countries is not democracy. The alternative in those countries is the Muslim Brotherhood, what some people would call Islamic extremism, but in fact is Sharia Islamic supremacy. That is the alternative. And so this is what eventually happened, after all, in the Arab Spring. And the result was what the Westerners now call an Arab winter. Excuse me. The so-called Arab winter, which is a period of widespread repression that followed the two revolutions. And as part of this Arab winter, there has been a coordinated effort by virtually all of the Arab world's monarchies to block constitutional reforms and expanded people power. Again, the reason for that is because the alternative to these monarchies and authoritarian dictatorships is not democracy. The alternative is the Muslim Brotherhood, so-called the Islamist extremists. Again, these are not Islamists in the sense of being different from Muslims. Islamist simply is a Muslim activist who wants to institute Sharia law just like it is supposed to be instituted and established in the countries. Jordan, Kuwait, and Bahrain have all suffered from recent attacks. And for example, in December, an assault linked to the Islamic State claimed the lives of 10 people in the southern Jordanian city of Karak, Kuwait has faced threats from both ISIS and Hezbollah, while Shiite militants have carried out various attacks in Bahrain. And all three countries are currently part of the Saudi-led coalition backing the Yemeni government in that country's civil war. Remember, there's a civil war going on in Yemen between the Shiites and the Sunnis. The Saudis, of course, are backing the Sunnis, and they have the backing of the Islamic State, the Gulf states, and Jordan. And so this further solidifies the Sunnis against the Shiites. And now in September of 2015, Britain's most senior foreign office official told the parliamentary committee that prosperity was now higher on the country's agenda than human rights. Now, we're talking about Saudi Arabia. Again, it's a false notion of human rights. There's nothing new about this. Saudi Arabia does have human rights, but they are Islamic human rights, which are absolutely antithetical to our human rights, and their focus on prosperity has nothing to do with their notion of human rights, which comes from the doctrines of Islam. So when Westerners look at this, they see focus on prosperity as somehow instead of human rights, but that's simply not true. Their notion, that is the Saudis and the Muslim government's notion of human rights, comes from Islam itself and has nothing to do with the economic situation. The so-called analysts have little hope that U.S. President Donald Trump will promote better human rights in the region. Well, of course he won't. He has other priorities, but no president has promoted human rights in Muslim countries. It goes all the way back. Whenever we had relations with the Muslim countries, we promoted governments in the Muslim countries, mainly the authoritarian dictatorships, and then we started promoting the Islamists. For example, President Carter helped to depose the Shah of Iran and to institute Khomeini as the leader of Iran, and of course he made Iran into the Islamic Republic of Iran, and there were no more human rights were possible in Iran because Iran then became a Muslim country. Let's turn our attention for a brief moment to what's going on in Syria. It's a complicated situation. Americans tend to think of the Syrian war as simply between Assad and everybody else. Well, but this everybody else includes a number of factions, and they are not united amongst one another. ISIS, of course, is the largest faction against Assad, but they're not the only ones. There's also Al-Qaeda. They are also against ISIS. But now we have a situation trying to form a coalition against ISIS. And then we have a problem now because one of the major forces against ISIS are the Kurds, who have populations in Iraq and Syria and Iran and Turkey. The Kurds want their own state. They've been wanting their own state for over 100 years, well, almost exactly 100 years. They were promised it 100 years ago after World War I, but they never got it. It's about 25 to 30 million people, and they have been wanting their own state all of this time. Well, they want it now, too, and Turkey believes that the Kurds are, in fact, our enemies of the Turks. Well, to an extent they are, I suppose, because the Turkish the Turkish Kurds want independence from Turkey. So Turkey has been fighting the Kurds. They don't want Kurdish independence in Iraq or in Syria. But now we have a situation where the Kurds in Syria want to help us fight ISIS. We are afraid of offending the Kurds if we, we're afraid of offending the Turks if we support the Kurds. And so if we allow the Kurds too much power in fighting ISIS, we are afraid that the Kurds will establish areas in Syria, which will then be under Kurdish domination, and that the Kurds will want to keep that as part of their Kurdish state, and that, of course, is something the Turks don't want. So here we have a conflict between the Turks and the Kurds, both of whom presumably are our allies. Now, Turkey, as I've mentioned, has long opposed Kurdish autonomy, and they consider many Kurds to be terrorists. And so the Kurds, for their part, view Turkey as an oppressor. So there's enmity between the Turks and the Kurds, even though both of them are supposed to be our allies in Syria. So this is obviously getting very complicated. Turkey is a much larger country than the Kurdish areas, and so we will tend to support Turks over the Kurds. This is true. John McCain has been saying that also. He has questioned our backing of the Syrian Kurdish fighters because that backing offends the Turks. The Turks don't want us to support the Kurds, and so we have allies fighting one another against Assad. As I say, this gets very complicated. It's not simply a war between Assad and the Sunnis. The Sunnis are divided on this question between the Turks and the Kurds. Let's look for a moment now at just what happened in Israel yesterday. A faction of Fatah's armed wing, that is the Al-Aqsa Martyrs Brigade, they said that they were responsible for firing two rockets into Israel from the Gaza Strip. Now, we think of the Gaza Strip as being controlled only by Hamas, but in fact, there are members of Fatah, which of course is the PLO, the armed wing of the PLO. They are active also in Gaza, and this time they fired rockets towards Israel also. We need to understand that in terms of the war against Israel, Fatah and Hamas have very little difference. Hamas is more religious. Fatah is basically religious, but more nationalistic. But the doctrines of Islam motivate both of them. The reason is they're all Muslims, and the basic doctrines of Islam prevent them all, that is, all of the Muslims, from recognizing Israel's right to exist. And this is just another example that the PLO's supporters, they are now also pursuing the war to the death against the Israelis. They want to destroy Israel. Also, their charter says so, just like the charter of Hamas says so, and so there's really no difference. And when we talk about moderate Palestinians versus Hamas, that is very misleading. The Palestinians of the PLO are not moderate. They have this murderous death cult against the Jews and against the Israelis, and they will continue to pursue that. And they have also said that there is no significant difference between their program and the program of Hamas. So keep in mind that all of the Palestinians, the PLO plus Hamas, they all want the destruction of Israel. And again, they want that destruction because the doctrines of Islam require it. The doctrines of Islam, that is, their God Allah and their Prophet Muhammad, have commanded Muslims to fight against the Jews and either subjugate them to Islamic law or to kill them. No Muslims are going to recognize Israel's right to exist as a Jewish state. Now, let's turn our attention again to Christianity and Islam. Just the other day, I was giving a presentation on Islam, of course, and somebody objected to calling Islam a religion at all. And that it should be called a cult or whatever, but it should not be called a religion. And my answer to that, and I would urge you also, do not fall into the trap of thinking that a religion has to be like your religion. It isn't. Religion has a definition, and the definition, for example, if you look it up on the internet or in any dictionary, religion means the belief in a god or a group of gods, an organized system of beliefs, ceremonies, and rules used to worship a god or group of gods. That is the definition of religion, and Islam meets that definition of religion in every way. So there's no way to say that Islam is not a religion. This is the definition of religion that is accepted by the entire world, and if we try to go against that, we will not be able to convince anybody. And remember, your job is to convince other people that Islam is a threat. Well, you cannot do that if you say that Islam is not a religion. So Islam is a religion, and what we need to do is to emphasize how Islam is different from all other religions, and it is different, again, because it is a totalitarian ideology in addition to being a religion. That is the point that you must mention when you talk to other people about Islam. Yes, it is a religion, but it is not a religion like other religions. And when you do this, you need to quote the Islamic religious authorities. After all, you're not a scholar of religion, and people are not going to believe you. However, if you quote the Islamic religious authorities, who tell us that Islam is not a religion like other religions because it organizes all aspects of life, that is, it's totalitarian, people will be more likely to accept that when it comes from the Islamic religious authorities themselves. That is why you need to always quote them. Please send me an email at ideologyofislam@cox.net, and I will be happy to send you the quotations from the Islamic religious authorities, which you can then use when you talk to other people about Islam. That is the authoritative and the effective way to help educate your and our fellow citizens about Islam. Always use the Islamic religious authorities. So Islam is a religion, but not like other religions. You could say, for example, that Islam is an ideological wolf in sheep's religious clothing. Or Islam is a religion plus an ideology, the totalitarian ideology. So it's a religion plus ideology, and that is what makes Islam fundamentally different from all other religions. Let's now continue for a few minutes about comparing Islam and Christianity. We've done that several times on this show already. It goes on, and the reason we're doing that is because Islam has been fighting Christianity for 1,400 years. They have invaded Europe on numerous occasions. Now the invasion of Europe is going on through migration, not through battles, although there are terrorist battles going on in Europe periodically. But in terms of the major invasion, that is now being done through the demographic jihad. So that is to overthrow Christian Europe. There is also massive persecution of Christians in all Muslim countries. And the question is why? And the answer is, well, it's Islamic doctrine. So that's why we should talk about Islamic doctrine. Muslims cannot change that. You can have Muslims, of course, who are very friendly towards Christians, but that is because they are not following Islam the way they are supposed to follow Islam. The Islamic doctrines require them to make war on Christians and subjugate them to Islamic law. So let's continue talking about the differences. Here, the Pope Francis's references to Islam, he said that Muslims revere and venerate Jesus, but that is not true at all. Muslims do not venerate Jesus. They consider Jesus to be a Muslim prophet, and that, of course, is the exact opposite of Christian teachings. Muslims believe, and this is in the Quran, that Jesus was not crucified and that he was not the Son of God, but only a prophet, and that's it. And not only that, but Jesus was not even considered the last of the prophets because that, according to Islamic doctrine, was Muhammad. So Christian revelation is only seen as a step towards the ultimate revelation brought by Muhammad, that is Islam. It is part of standard Islam that Islam came to replace Christianity. And therefore, Christianity is no longer a valid religion. Now, in fact, the Quran is opposed to all the fundamental Christian dogmas, and this Jesuit goes on to say that all of the Christian dogmas are rejected by the Quran and Islam. The Quran and Muslims deny the essential dogmas of Christianity, for example, the Trinity, the Incarnation, and the Redemption. Those are essential doctrines of Christianity, and Islam denies them all. You cannot say that the sacred writings of Islam retain part of the Christian teachings. Sometimes Christians, and that includes Pope Francis, will say that Islam retains part of the Christian teachings, but that is just not true, that the Jesus of the Quran has nothing to do with the Jesus of the Gospels. What about fundamentalism? Well, it's the Pope talks about fundamentalism in all religions, that all religions have their fundamentalists. However, because Islam is fundamentally different from all other religions, including Christianity, Christian fundamentalism is fundamentally different from Islamic fundamentalism. Of course, there is fundamentalism on all sides. However, they cannot be placed on the same level because Christian fundamentalists do not carry weapons. Muslim fundamentalism is criticized, first of all, by Muslims themselves, precisely because this armed fundamentalism seeks to replicate the Mohammedan model. Remember, the Quran, which is considered to be Allah's literal word by all Muslims, even if they have never read it, the Quran requires Muslims to follow the example of Muhammad. And if they do that, Muhammad, of course, took part in and organized many, many wars, dozens of wars against non-Muslims in Arabia, and that is the model for Muslims to follow, and that includes war against Christianity. So the Mohammedan model, and by the way, the word Mohammedan, it used to be that Muslims were called Mohammedans, and there's good reason for that, again, because they are required to follow the example of Muhammad, and therefore they could be reasonably called Mohammedans. Muslims don't like that, but we need to understand that they are required to follow Muhammad's example. And so it's not surprising at all that if Muhammad is considered the supreme model and Muhammad led a life of violence against non-Muslims, so it's not surprising that some Muslims also use their violence in imitation of Muhammad. So there's talk about violence in the Quran and the life of Muhammad. There is nothing like that in the Gospels. Many people like to say that, and that includes the Pope, who says that the true interpretation of Islam and the Quran is opposed to violence. Well, that's simply not true at all. And there are many quotations from Muslim religious authorities telling us that violence is required by Muslims against non-Muslims. You make war against them, well, war is violent. And therefore, it is simply false to say that the true interpretation of Islam and the Quran is opposed to violence. They cannot support that. People who say that cannot support that by any quotations from the Quran and Muhammad. The quotations from Quran and Muhammad will require violence. And so even though that phrase is beautiful and expresses a very benevolent attitude on the Pope's part towards Islam, nevertheless, this Jesuit goes on to say that it expresses more of a wish than a reality. The fact that the majority of Muslims are opposed to violence may well be true. Well, it may or it may not, depends on how you measure it. But he goes on to say, to say that the true Islam is against any violence does not seem true. There is violence in the Quran. Well, he's putting it very mildly. It does not seem true because it isn't true. So even the best of intentions on the part of the Pope are not enough to change Islamic doctrine. And it's not enough to change historical facts in the present reality, which is evident for anybody who keeps an eye on what is going on in the Muslim world. So he goes on to say, we need to examine Islamic doctrine objectively and stick to the truth of events so that we don't lose touch with reality. And this, by the way, is what you will find among almost universally among Democrats and leftists, that they will not examine Islamic doctrine, either objectively or unobjectively. They won't even look at Islamic doctrine, because if they did, they would have to see all of these commandments towards violence in the Quran, and as part of their leftist ideology, they are never permitted to criticize Islam. So unless we look at Islamic doctrine objectively, even though we may have the best of intentions, or the Pope may have the best of intentions, the Jesuit goes on to say, we risk falling into the realm of utopia and unreality. Only then, with the help of divine providence, can we seek real solutions to one of the most pressing problems of our time, the resurgence of political Islam. Well, notice that he, even though he disagrees with the Pope, he talks about political Islam, the resurgence of political Islam. Let's look at that. The fact is, there is no such thing as political Islam. I myself have talked to Muslims and asked them about that, and they simply frown. When I ask them, what do you think of political Islam, they frown and they tell me there is no such thing. The notion of political Islam, in fact, was invented by Westerners who were afraid to criticize Islam itself. There is no such thing as political Islam. Why? Because Islam itself, that is, the Quran and the sayings of Muhammad, that is Islam, the belief system, contains politics because, as they tell us, it's a complete way of life. It covers everything, covers all aspects of life from birth to death, including politics. Again, I will be happy to send you the writings of the Islamic religious authorities who tell us that Islam includes politics. You cannot take politics out of Islam, and therefore there is no such thing as political Islam. Islam is the belief system, and it contains politics. And by the way, this Jesuit speaks of a resurgence of political Islam, but that is not true. Islam has always been political and has always striven to dominate the world whenever it had the power to do so. It did that during Muhammad's time. When he had the power, he expanded his Muslim community, forced Islam on all of Arabia. After he died, the Muslim armies from Arabia spread out and conquered nearly everything from Spain almost to China, through India and Persia, all through war. That certainly was political Islam in the sense that they established the political state, the Islamic Empire. That is political Islam, and it was from the very beginning. They tried it several times to expand in Europe, and the thing is that they are also commanded to promote jihad, war against non-Muslims, when the military power becomes available. And so during those periods when the West was so dominant, a Muslim simply could not promote jihad because they didn't have the military power to do so. It doesn't mean that they didn't want to. Of course, they always wanted to, but they couldn't. And now the so-called resurgence has come about because the Muslim world has unlimited money, essentially, from selling us oil. The West, and now, of course, the developed economies of the Orient, they also are the ones that make oil valuable. The Arabs never did anything to make oil valuable, only the West did. And the West was foolish enough to allow Saudi Arabia and the other Muslim countries to keep the oil, to have rights over the oil, and as a result, those countries have unlimited money, and they are using that money to spread Islam. Here's a section called Outright Lies in the Quran. One of the outright lies is that Muhammad was foretold in the Bible. Well, of course, Muhammad was not foretold in the Bible at all. Another one, the Torah and the Gospels promise paradise to those who are killed, who kill and are killed for the sake of Allah. That's what it says in the Quran, that both the Torah and the Gospel promise paradise to those who are killed and who kill for the sake of Allah. Well, that is a lie. There's nothing in the Gospels which promise Christians will go to heaven if they kill non-Christians. There's nothing in the Torah that promises Jews that they will go to paradise if they kill non-Jews. In fact, Jesus said, those who live by the sword will die by the sword. What about treatment of non-believers? The Bible says, love your enemies and pray for those who persecute you. That's in the Gospels in Matthew. The Quran says, believers, take neither Jews nor Christians for your friends. Believers make war on the infidels who dwell around you and deal firmly with them. Jesus said, if you obey my teaching, you are really my disciples. You will know the truth, and the truth will set you free. The Quran says, believers, do not ask questions about things which, if made known to you, would only pain you. Other men inquired about them before you, only to disbelieve them thereafter. This is a standard dogma of Islam, that you don't ask questions. You simply obey what is in the Quran. You obey what Muhammad said. And in fact, this appears many times in the Quran. Muslims must obey Allah and his messenger, that is, Muhammad. The goal for mankind, in the Bible it says God wants everyone to be saved and to come to know the truth. Does not want anyone to be destroyed. The Quran says God sends astray whom he wills and guides whom he wills, but you will certainly be called to account for what you used to do. So even though you are disobeying what God wants, you are doing that because that is what God wants you to do. In other words, God wants you to disobey him because that's what it says in the Quran. Strangely enough, the Quran says, we have predestined for hell many men. No matter what you do, that's God's will in the Quran, Allah's will, that Allah guides whom he will and misguides whom he will. That doesn't seem to leave much choice for people. What about assurance of salvation? The Bible says everyone who believes in Jesus may not die but have eternal life. So that is the assurance of salvation in Christianity. In the Quran, paradise is assured only for those who slay and are slain in the cause of God. That's verse 9:111. And this is the only way for Muslims to get to paradise right away without waiting for Judgment Day. In other words, it's the only guarantee of going to paradise is when you kill non-Muslims and die in the process. So the question again, is Jesus the Son of God? Well, this is very clear in Christianity. Jesus is the Son of God. In the Quran, it says very specifically, Jesus is not the Son of God, and Jesus is only a Muslim prophet. Here's a rather rare item, marriage to one's daughter-in-law. Muhammad lusted after, and he married his adopted son's wife, Zainab. This happened, and in fact, after his adopted son had married Zainab, taken her as his wife, Muhammad fell in love with her, and so what he did was got a revelation from Allah saying it was permissible to marry his adopted son's wife, but that obviously goes against what the Bible says. It says, do not have intercourse with your daughter-in-law. Well, in Islam, he made his adopted son divorce his wife first, and then Muhammad had her as his wife. The Quran said, and this is the verse that Muhammad got when he wanted to have intercourse with his daughter-in-law, it said, it should become legitimate for true believers to wed the wives of their adopted sons if they divorced them. God's will must needs be done. That should be it for today. We will continue next week. Remember, next week, New York time, 1 o'clock to 2 o'clock. California time, 10 to 11. And Arizona time remains the same, 10 to 11. Please talk to as many people as you can this week about Islam and educate yourself about Islam. Learn a little bit more about Islamic doctrine. Get yourself a copy of the Quran if you haven't done so, and please read it. Thank you. Have a good week.
Judy was boring.
Hello.
Then Judy discovered Chumbacasino.com.
It's my little escape.
Now Judy's the life of the party.
Oh, baby, mama's bringing home the bacon.
Whoa, take it easy, Judy. The Chumba life is for everybody. So go to Chumbacasino.com and play over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.